when countries get frequently hit by natural disasters, and these disasters are likely going to get worse, this is something that clearly matters for the economy.
And the disheartening thing is that it seems that no matter how hard these countries try, any country, adaptation will never be enough.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. I'm Bruce Edwards. In this program, how climate change is affecting GDP.
So my name is Natalia Novta. I'm at the research department.
And I'm Sebastián Acevedo. I'm currently an economist at the African department.
As the annual average global temperature is expected to rise by 4 degrees Celsius by the end of this century, economic output, or productivity, in countries with hot climates continues to fall. And given most low-income countries are located in hot regions, low-income countries are in a lot of ways bearing the brunt of climate change, even though they contribute very little to the greenhouse gas emissions that cause it. Sebastián Acevedo and Natalia Novta are both IMF economists and co-authors of a recent research paper on policies to help low-income countries better handle weather shocks.
So can you see a direct correlation between rising temperatures and output in certain countries?
Yes, absolutely yes. And not just that we see a correlation, but we can be quite confident in saying that there's a causal relationship. And the reason that we can be confident is because when we look at weather shocks, which we were using to identify the relationship between temperature and GDP, we know that GDP cannot predict the weather in the short run, while the weather can and does affect GDP. And what our research shows is that for emerging markets, the decline in GDP from a 1 degree Celsius increase in temperature, the cumulative decline over 7 years is about 1%. And for low-income countries that are warmer on average, the decline is about 1.5%. And these are large effects.
And Sebastián, so how does the level of development affect a country's ability to mitigate the effects of climate change?
Well, in general, richer countries have more available resources to reduce the negative impacts from climate shocks. For example, the use of certain technologies like air conditioning, irrigation, and investments in R&D for drought and temperature-resistant crops are more commonly found in advanced economies. Also, advanced economies can more easily finance investments in climate-resilient infrastructure like sea defenses and weather-resistant electricity grids. Another good example is the Smart Tunnel in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. They built a three-level tunnel, and the top two levels are used for cars, reducing congestion and traffic. And the lower level is used as a drainage system that helps when there are flash floods. And when you have moderate or severe storms, the top two levels can also be used as a drainage system, so preventing damages from excessive rain. Mm. So that's a few of the examples of how development helps countries adapt to shocks.
And Natalia, maybe you want to jump in?
Yeah, maybe now's a good time to explain the difference between adaptation and mitigation. So some of the things that Sebastián has mentioned are adaptation strategies. And adaptation means just ways in which countries can reduce the damage from weather shocks, whereas mitigation includes all the strategies where countries reduce their emissions of CO2, carbon dioxide, and other greenhouse gases. So reducing emissions will help fight climate change in the long term. And for advanced economies, mitigation is a priority, both because they have immediate benefits such as less pollution, smog, etc., but also because their decline in emissions makes a big difference globally. But advanced economies also, as Sebastián mentioned, have a lot of adaptation strategies, and that has helped them reduce the damages that they do suffer. Perhaps it's also interesting to mention that, you know, for a long time, it was hard for researchers to know for sure whether the relatively lower damages that we see from temperature shocks in advanced countries are because advanced countries are better at adapting or because they are relatively cooler. Because we do see that in the hottest parts of the world, they're almost exclusively lower-income countries. And then the advanced economies are almost exclusively in the more temperate climates. And one way to get around that problem that we used, and we were among the first to do so, is we looked at subnational data, where we can use the fact that there are some advanced economies, large advanced economies, such as the United States, Australia, parts of Europe, that have actually some regions that have very hot climates. And then we can compare these hot regions in advanced economies to hot regions in lower-income countries. And we do see that the damages are lower in hot regions of advanced economies compared to hot regions in poorer countries, which means that they are, in fact, have been successful to a degree.
Better prepared, better infrastructure, and
precisely,
et cetera. And you just mentioned there how severe these weather shocks are on some of the lower income countries. Mm-hmm. How realistic is it, do you think, for these countries like Bahamas, for example, who just recently got hit with a severe hurricane? How realistic is it to think that small countries like that can actually be prepared to deal with these weather shocks?
Well, that is a very difficult question to answer, particularly for small islands like the Bahamas, that when they are hit by a hurricane, it's mostly the entire country or a large portion of it which gets hit. However, building climate resilient infrastructure and having strong building codes and enforcing those building codes can help protect lives and reduce damages. That said, you can probably never be fully protected against a Category 5 hurricane that makes landfall directly in a populated area. But countries can prepare by having strong hurricane-resistant shelters, having up-to-date emergency and evacuation plans, and making sure not to build in high-risk areas.
But when we're talking about construction standards and preparedness in terms of infrastructure, these countries don't necessarily or can't necessarily afford that level of quality infrastructure. Are there ways that they can sort of do this in a manner where they're not, you know, increasing the burden or increasing debt?
Yeah, that's a challenge. Like you mentioned, these countries are usually not rich countries, so they probably need help from the international community to finance some of these resilient building in infrastructure. Those kind of things are not cheap. They're not easy to do. Mm-hmm. So this probably will mean that these are long-term projects that will require countries to prepare for them, and by that I mean having the governments including their budgets climate resilient infrastructure, that from now on any new infrastructure project financed by public funds needs to be resilient not only to what is happening now but what will happen in the future.
So the low-income countries, which are hardest hit by climate, also tend to have a very large agricultural sector, and meaning that, you know, that there's a lot of people, when disaster hits, a lot of people are out of work and not making money, making it even more difficult for them to recover. What kind of policies can these low-income countries implement to sort of alleviate that burden when climate-related disaster hits?
Well, from a macroeconomic perspective, what you would like to see are policies that build buffers and enable countries to respond to shocks. For example, the Productive Safety Net program in Ethiopia is a great example of how low-income countries can take some of the challenges. For example, in Ethiopia, most of the population works in the agricultural sector, and they're vulnerable to droughts and floods. And when this happens, this affects household incomes. And so about 10% of the population are food insecure. So what the program does is that they provide food or cash transfers to households that cannot feed themselves in exchange for participation in productivity enhancing or environmentally friendly projects like rehabilitating land or protecting water sources. And the project has been successful in reducing soil loss by about 40% and improving access and quality of water and reducing damages from seasonal flooding. What you would also like to see is some flexibility in labor markets. When you have a shock in one particular sector, you want people to be able to find jobs either on a temporary basis or on a permanent basis in another region or another sector of the economy. So having that type of flexibility is also useful for countries.
Diversification would help.
Yeah, exactly.
And Natalia, so the approach that people take on an individual level to deal with the changing climate isn't, according to your research, isn't necessarily good at the aggregate level. Why is that?
Yeah, so sometimes that happens. I mean, in general, anything that reduces greenhouse gas emissions by anyone and everyone is helpful, and it aggregates globally and should be promoted. But there are some examples, and air conditioning is a notable such example, where on the one hand, it's a great individual adaptation strategy. It's very important for people's health, especially for vulnerable populations like little kids or elderly people. And in general, just it improves productivity of workers. So as emerging markets are growing, their economies are growing, and GDP per capita is rising, people are installing air conditioning. And that's fantastic. But it comes at the cost. Some of these large emerging markets actually use coal to generate electricity. And this emits a lot of greenhouse gases, a lot of CO2. And that's a problem in aggregate. So on the one hand, it's good for individuals. But if used, if it increases the consumption of electricity generated by coal, it can be a big problem.
So in the end, does your research suggest that environmentally friendly policies are also good economic policies? Or is there a paradox there?
There is no paradox. The answer is yes, absolutely yes. Both academic and policy research unambiguously shows that environmentally friendly policies are necessary for sustainable growth. And growth that comes at the expense of pollution, increased pollution, is not sustainable. Basically, we should be taking that into account. Now, what is less clear is which specific policies that address climate issues can be implemented that would provide the needed reduction in emissions, but without excessive political cost. It's really that political economy dimension that is controversial in some countries. And that's something that policymakers in general and we as somebody who advises and informs these debates have to be very much aware of.
So between the both of you, where do you think you're both IMF economists, where does the IMF's work fit in all of this?
I mean, a lot of the issues that we see, helping our planet, right, the reducing emissions, reducing climate change, improving the environment, that's a public good, and it's an international public good. And as we've all learned in economics, public goods are special in many ways, and it's hard to coordinate individual countries for the benefit of, in this case, a global public good. And the IMF being an international organization that facilitates multilateral discussions and climate change affecting GDP, both individual countries and globally, I think we can play a role in informing this discussion.
I just want to add that when countries get frequently hit by natural disasters, and these disasters are likely going to get worse with climate change, this is something that clearly matters for the economy and for policymakers. So that recognition at the macroeconomic level has pushed the institution to focus more on these issues.
Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Sebastián Acevedo and Natalia Nofta are both IMF economists and co-authors of Weather Shocks and Output in Low-Income Countries, Adaptation and the Role of Policies. You can find that paper and other research on the economic impact of climate change at imf.org. And if you like this podcast, look for us on Spotify or on your favorite podcast app. Just search for IMF Podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast.